are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, October 29th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the great Harvey Kay will be in studio telling us to take hold of our history, make America radical again. Also on the program, yet another Trump administration official says quid pro quo. Meanwhile, the Democrats have agreed to hold the meaningless impeachment vote so demanded by the Republicans. Meanwhile, goalpost movers have been hired. Missouri could shutter its only abortion clinic this week. And a new report, minimum wage hike adds dollars, does not subtract jobs. Bernie Sanders says he will leverage U.S. aid to Israel. And the North Carolina congressional redistricting map thrown out again. Meanwhile, Georgia looking to boot 300,000 off its voter rolls in anticipation of 2020. Trump's rescue fails as the biggest private coal mine goes bust. And over 100,000 New York City students are homeless. It is more than one out of 10 students who go to classrooms every day in New York City are homeless. Lastly, Andrew Cuomo's secret or not so secret plan to kill the WFP and all third party voting in New York, except of course the Conservative Party. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Full compliment in the studio today, including Harvey Kay, who will be joining us shortly. Thank you for joining us. Just a reminder, AM Quickie every morning. Go subscribe to it now. You can get it through our app at majorityapp.com, or you can just go to amquickie.com. You can sign up through there or wherever your podcasts are served. Give us a review. It's very helpful, and we appreciate your listening. We're getting very good feedback from it, and I can't quite figure out from the stats how we're doing. There's some things that are not quite jibing, but we got about half of the people who were listening when it was on the Majority Report feed, and we want to get all of the people who are listening on the Majority Report feed. So go sign up to it, subscribe. 5 minutes in the morning, you will enjoy it, and do so right this minute. We will wait. Okay. Two big things have happened on the, well, three things, I guess, on the impeachment front. One, the Democrats, as you know, the Republicans were saying that this is a sham process because there is not a specific vote to start an impeachment inquiry. There is no need for a vote to start the impeachment inquiry. In the past, it was necessary, but rules changes that have happened subsequent to the last impeachment allow the House committees that are investigating the president to do so without having a full vote in the House. The full vote would come later when the articles of impeachment are introduced. However, Nancy Pelosi has basically decided to call the bluff of the Republicans because this will give them virtually nothing to talk about after the fact. So you will see the pivots begin already. They will have this vote. And we will talk a little bit more about that in a moment. We'll get to that. But the other thing was that y'all remember Gordon Sondland. He was the EU ambassador, hotelier, who had given $1 million to Donald Trump's inauguration bust of a festival.
Best people.
Exactly. And he was the main ringleader for the attempts to get the Ukraine, or get Ukraine, I should say, to, at the very least, hold a press conference and say they were investigating Joe Biden. And he had claimed no quid pro quo. That was until Bill Taylor testified. And then all of a sudden he remembered, wait a second, no, I meant there was a quid pro quo because I am a hotelier and I can't run my hotels if I'm in prison. So apparently his attorney last night, confirmed that, in fact, Sondland did testify that there was a quid pro quo. And as he went back in for a, sort of a corrective disposition deposition. So he did say there was a quid pro quo to the extent that he can make that determination because he's not a lawyer. Because if you if there's anything you've done that can be expressed in Latin, apparently you need to be a lawyer to know whether you've done it or not. Meanwhile, now we're going to see part of the pivot. And part of the pivot is going to be that, okay, there was a quid pro quo, but that doesn't mean anything. And they have to do that because there's now this is a completely new individual, a lieutenant colonel, last name of Vindman, who is going to be testifying today that he was national security on the national security team, spoke Ukrainian, and apparently was born in Ukraine. Apparently, he was also bothered by what happened directly on the call. He didn't even know all the backstory of what was actually going on. And he confronted Sondland and also told John Bolton that there was a problem here. So understand there's two elements, really, to this whole story in terms of the quid pro quo. One is the not-so-specific transcript, or at least the assessment of the call, the representation of the call. There were the people who were actually there listening to the call. And then there's the whole story of what all the underlings were doing in the background relative to that call. So, you know, I can tell Matt here, Matt, I want this show to be successful and get advertising bought. And then Matt goes and tells Brendan, we got to buy advertising. Jamie, make posters. So we have both elements of that, both my conversation with Matt and what Matt is coordinating with other people to execute my agenda. Here's Laura Ingraham, and this is what they're going to do. They're going to chuckle a lot when they talk about this. And why are they going to do that? Because that's going to communicate to their audience that this is no big deal. This is sort of the inverse of why it was so important for the Democrats to have impeachment and to announce that it's impeachable. Because when they do, it is a cue to the audience saying, like, this is serious. But if we chuckle during it, it's not serious. Wait till we get to when we talk about the wildfires in California and we all just laugh and no one's going to take it seriously. But here is Laura Ingraham chuckling her way through this whole thing. And it's especially notable because she has on her show, a torture enabler and an accused pedophile.
This is buried in the New York Times piece tonight, but I found it very interesting. He's a decorated colonel, by the way, in the Iraq War. But because Colonel Vindman emigrated from Ukraine along with his family when he was a child and is fluent in Ukrainian and Russian, Ukrainian officials sought advice from him about how to deal with Mr. Giuliani, though they typically communicated in English. Now, wait a second, John. Here we have a U.S. national security official.
Pause it. Let me tell you something. That is such a fake laugh. It's a fake laugh. All right. I worked in the entertainment business. That's a fake laugh. Just to be clear, Ukrainian officials were so freaked out by Rudy Giuliani that they spoke to a national security advisor in the White House to try and figure out, like, how are we supposed to, like, what are we supposed to do here? It had nothing to do with the fact that they spoke English or that Giuliani did. The question is, like, wait, this guy's not a government official. Well, how are we supposed to deal with him? And we trust you because you're Ukrainian. You were born in Ukraine. You may have a little bit more insight as to how we're supposed to react.
Now, wait a second, John. Here we have a U.S. national security official who is advising Ukraine while working inside the White House, apparently against the president's interest, and usually they spoke in English. Isn't that kind of an interesting angle on this story?
I find that astounding, and, you know, some people might call that espionage, but it doesn't actually seem to add any new facts to what we know.
Pause it for one more second. The president's own interests were represented by his personal lawyer. It cannot be espionage, because espionage is when you undertake to subvert something that has to do with national security, not the president's own interests. This is, I mean, first of all, he's at Berkeley, right? Like, if you're a Berkeley law student, you should go down to the registrar's office and see if you can transfer now.
Yeah, walk out.
I mean, it's disgusting. It was disgusting when this guy was rehabilitated before. It's disgusting.
Any new facts to what we know? If, you know, in terms of, I think Alan raises a good point. Is this a high crime and misdemeanor? Whether you have one person or five people all saying, well, we objected to what the president said with the president of Ukraine, we have the transcript of the call. We can all make our judgment. I don't see how this breaking news actually adds more facts to what we know about whether this is an impeachable offense or not.
It doesn't add any facts. It just has one more person who clearly will testify it was quid pro quo. And to a certain extent, I agree with John Yoo. You could have impeached the president 3 weeks ago based upon what we know on that transcript. But the fact is, it's a political process. And if you have a dozen people who say there was a quid pro quo, it makes it that much stronger of a case. But the idea that this is espionage and we should be worried because somehow he was born in Ukraine. You know who else was not born in the United States? John Yoo. Born in South Korea, apparently, back in 1967. There was a lot of communist agents running around South Korea in mid-60s.
Sleeper cell.
Yeah, it could be. Honestly, though, for anybody who has any shock that John Yoo is a right-wing hack, I would point you to every reason why you know John Yoo's name as to what should have established that for you beforehand. We will talk more about this later in the program. But speaking of which, I don't know if Korean is on the the list, but Babbel will get you speaking a new language quickly and with confidence. You can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian. Russian's on there, right? What else we have? Turkish?
Dutch.
Spanish.
Indonesian.
Danish.
Portuguese.
You could go ask people in Denmark as to how their healthcare is doing. Or you could maybe get a job with Michael Flynn and speak Turkish. Babbel's teaching method and speech recognition technology has been proven effective across multiple studies. And Babbel's lessons, unlike other language apps and whatnot, are created by over 100 language experts, real people, not by a translation machine. Lessons are engaging. They're convenient. They last about 10 to 15 minutes. So you can do it. I don't know. I could do it. I could do two lessons on my way to work. You can learn through interactive dialogue so you can perfect your pronunciation and accent. Babbel is available as an app or online, and your progress syncs across all the devices. When are we going to do this, Jamie, with the Spanish off?
Anytime you want.
Is that... are you wearing that because of Dia de Muerte?
Oh, Oh, no, this is actually a shirt from the Trillbillies and Street Fight tour. They gave it to me after I appeared at their show in Atlanta.
Oh, all right.
And I love Trillbilly Workers' Party so much and Street right. Fight.
Well, they're we're talking about Spanish, though. That's why Sorry. I brought that up. But because you listen to the show, Babbel has a very special offer for you. Go to Babbel.com, select the language of your choice. Once you try for free and are ready to sign up, select the three-month option, and Babbel will give you three additional months. For free with the promo code MAJORITY. That's 6 months for the cost of three with the promo code MAJORITY. Go to Babbel, BABBEL.com. Enter promo code MAJORITY. Babbel, speak a new language with confidence. And also, I'm always proud that when support for today's show comes from the New Yorker. I don't need to tell you, New Yorker represents the best writing in America today. You can read Doreen St. Felix. She's staff writer at The New Yorker. She covers the highs and lows of today's culture. This is very important for me because I don't really have any access to culture outside of this. And she won the Ellie Award for columns and commentary in 2019. John Cassidy covers politics and economics for The New Yorker. He's written articles on topics ranging from the intelligence failures before the Iraqi war to the economics of John Maynard Keynes. As you know, folks, we have New Yorker writers on this show. We have for years when, the stories they've just broken that are, you know, in the news, not only do they break stories that make news, but the breaking of those stories often make news, right? I mean, like all the stuff with Ronan Farrow, everything that has come out. Half of the things that we talk about, I feel like on some one level or another, end up are in play because of The New Yorker. It is an invaluable resource and also just amazing writing. And now you can get 12 weeks for just $6. Plus, you get a New Yorker tote bag. It's weekly home delivery of the print edition, unlimited access to NewYorker.com, 10 to 15 exclusive site-only stories every day. When you go to NewYorker.com/majority, enter the code MAJORITY. You'll also be able to access the apps, online archive, crossword puzzle, more. Again, that's NewYorker.com/majority. Enter the code MAJORITY to save 50% off on a 12-week subscription and get the exclusive tote. It's worth it just for the tote. 12 issues for $6?
Come on.
And lastly, tonight's the night, actually. Mile and I have been waiting. So I'm with the kids half the time. And we were supposed to play last night, but I had to go do MSNBC. And what are we playing? Hunt a Killer. It's the murder mystery subscription box that immerses you in an ongoing detective experience. With every delivery, you'll sift through elaborate case files and evidence, eliminating suspects until you crack the case and catch the killer. Hunt a Killer gets you talking, having fun together, whether it's game night or date night. And if you're a detective that prefers to work solo, Hunt a Killer is built so you can choose how you want to play. 2000 five-star review on Trustpilot. No wonder Fast Company named it as one of the most innovative entertainment companies of 2019. Plus, part of the proceeds of every box go to the Cold Case Foundation to help fund cold case investigations. I ordered the red string came in. We've got the black. We've got the bulletin board. We've got a new case. Our case file came a week ago or so, maybe a week and a half. Mile and I are going to start putting up the things. It has to do with a bunch of people came back for a homecoming high school. And now we're starting to eliminate some of the suspects. And we're going, and it's fun. It's literally the only thing that Myla and I do together that does not involve me telling her, don't do that. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. Hurry to take advantage of this offer and embrace your inner detective. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. huntakiller.com/majority. Check it out right now. All right, let's take a quick musical interlude, and then Harvey K will be walking into the studio, as it were, or walking over. I mean, just switching seats.
Come a little far, come a little far, stay.
But this thing about sort of there was no plan or
there's
something.
There's no plan.
In some way, even if I can intellectually get there with you, there's something about that idea that then he duped by. It's scary, I guess I would say. It's pretty scary to think that someone who had no plan duped the rest of us. Like that inherently seems like a plan at some level. Next, they use the pejorative right wing to opine on Ben's talk show and his views. Of course, there's no doubt that as a conservative, Ben's political views are on the right. But there's something else when they say right wing. Virtually every time the mainstream media uses the phrase right wing, it's to paint someone as either scary, evil, or as a racist.
We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. In studio, it is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies, Director of Center for History and Social Change at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, award-winning author of several books, here to discuss, well, maybe not just this one, but maybe others. Harvey K is here with his latest Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. Harvey, such a pleasure to have you here.
Hold it up.
Oh, no, thank you. Here it is.
Thank you.
I mean, we should be clipping that in. Is his mic on?
Yeah, sure.
Good.
Hello.
Oh, wait, hold on.
Michael in charge of the tech on that, and that's why we couldn't hear you.
Thank you for having me in the studio.
thanks for being here. Now this is a series of essays and speeches that you've given really over the past almost 10 years.
Almost 10 years, right.
And it both makes a cogent argument across the board, but also gives you a little sense of where things were sort of going a little bit at the time, if you sort of read behind the, you know, in the context. But let's just start with, I mean, I know who your three favorite people are, at least in history, I think, at this point. Let's start with Max Lerner.
Ah, okay. Right.
I mean, tell us about Max Lerner. Who was he? Why is he important for us today?
Max Lerner, I'll start with the fact that in the 1930s, he called himself, capital M, capital D, Marxist Democrat. He was a PhD in social sciences who turned to journalism and editorial writing, and in the 30s was writing columns for all the, you know, major left-wing magazines and newspapers. And he basically offered this really interesting take because he was clearly a Marxist, but he had serious reservations about the Communist Party. And he wrote a book in 1938. It's variably dated, 38, 39. Basically, it's too late, basically, what he's saying is we need a militant democracy in this book. And it's an argument in favor of democratic socialism and socialist democracy. Basically, that the United States should embrace this kind of politics because the world is being challenged by fascism on the march. And during the war, it actually came out in a revised edition. He, late in life, it's my impression he became something of a neoconservative. But that's not until sort of late 60s into the 70s. He also happens to be the father of someone we've all heard of, Michael Lerner of Tycoon magazine. Mm-hmm. But what I liked about...
I'm listening.
Max Lerner was the kind of writer who, to my mind, captured the imperative of linking the sort of Marxian tradition and the social democratic tradition by way of Roosevelt. And his essays just always spoke to me. And the essays that are laid out in the sort of forward area, to my mind, just speak, I think, to the moment that we're in.
All right. Well, so what is that moment? I mean, and how is it? I mean, and compare that to the moment. And because it's interesting. Yesterday we had on the program Matt Stoller, who wrote more or less a 100-year history of anti-monopolism in this country, or monopolies and the fights against them, with the idea of making sure that we understood what, you know, where we've been in this country. I think to expand our imagination of where we can go, at least in the context of his perspective, which isn't necessarily social democratic or Marxian as much as it is about constraining capitalism in a specific way.
Yeah, I think last week I saw something of his on Twitter in which he denied that in any way FDR might have been a sort of early Bernie Sanders, or Bernie Sanders is a later FDR. I may have the wrong guy. But
I don't know if that's the case. But I mean, I think he would argue that he probably was similar.
Okay.
But I think but the point being that the value in understanding historic traditions in this country.
Yeah.
Why is that important? But also, how does what Max Lerner wrote 90 years ago,
okay,
relevant.
Well, let me start. I'm not going to make a case specifically for the radical tradition, as in Thomas Paine, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. I do that all the time.
Right.
But I think we're in a situation comparable to 1938. I mean, I think that we are in a crisis right now that really does recall the crises of the 1770s, the 1860s, the 1930s and 40s. Now, why do I mean by that? We are facing a mortal crisis. I don't mean just Donald Trump. I mean, we're facing a mortal crisis, which is a consequence of 45 years of class war on the solidarities of American working people, both by way of specifically trying to bust unions, take back the voting rights of people of color, and literally seek the invasion of women's bodies. And I think for 45 years, it's the Republicans in cahoots with corporate America that have pursued that. However, the biggest problem, and I think if people pick up the book, they'll see, my criticisms are also directed at the Democrats. Because for 45 years, the Democrats turned their backs on the tradition of, well, in simple terms, the FDR tradition. But let's put it this way, the tradition of the Democratic Party as the party of working people, the party of the people. And so we find ourselves in a situation after all these many decades in which we really do face a crisis, a mortal crisis. If you consider the inequality that prevails in the United States, if you consider the very events that have been licensed after these 45 years conducted by the current administration, whether it has to do with denying the United States as an asylum for mankind and denying refugees a place, if it has to do with the fact that we have literally not just separated parents and children at the border, we've literally encaged them. I mean, this is, people will tell us, well, we've seen these kinds of things before in America. But before, in the 1770s, the 1860s, the 1930s, somehow we found it in ourselves to organize, to press, and to turn America into what it should be all the more effectively. We turned America into, we created radical moments. So we confronted the British in the 1770s, and we created not just an independent country, but the makings of a democratic republic for all of the faults and failings. In the 1860s, Lincoln is president, and there's that speech that I opened the book with in December 1862, fellow citizens, we know what we must do. And he makes the case. The whole world knows what we must do. And what we must do is we must bring an end to slavery, not only for the slaves, but also for ourselves. In the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt is elected president, there's an empowerment of working people. And not just in the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, but even in the National Industrial Recovery Act right at the outset of the administration. And over again in the Roosevelt years, we not only see top-down initiatives of a capital P progressive sort, we also see the empowerment of working people. And we see even Roosevelt himself at various times calling on people to mobilize and organize. As in 1935, he says, laws in themselves do not bring the new millennium. Okay, and what he had his cabinet members do is literally encourage working people and working households to organize. We're in a situation now where we need that kind of call. Americans are yearning to be American. And I think we saw it especially back in 2015-16 to begin with, when vast numbers, every primary, even in places where that Bernie lost, we saw young people mobilizing to Bernie's banner. I live in Wisconsin. We were devastated by the election of Scott Walker in 2010. Right. We lost our collective bargaining rights. Universities were devastated. Eventually, it became a right-to-work state. And we were the first state to grant collective bargaining rights
Wisconsin
to public employees.
Sort of famously, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, we were the home of Capital P progressivism with La Follette's. So what we see around us right now is a crisis, and I think young people have responded very effectively to it. And whether you support Bernie or Warren, the fact is that if you put Bernie and Warren together, their support, it's clear I'm on the Majority Report, and we are the majority.
Right. Well, so let me ask you this. I mean, and this is when we compare what's happening, you know, in terms of the era of the 1930s, let's say. It seems one of the things that I worry about is, and you know, Wisconsin's a good example. I know you're obviously writing about the protests out there. I think one of the first shows, you know, within the first 6 months of launching this iteration of the show, the first I think live broadcast I did was walking around the Capitol building on the final
Saturday. That's the kind of support we needed, and we will never forget it.
But following that, there was, and you know, I think there's a, I probably did, I don't know, a dozen interviews on, was this the right move strategically to sort of like channel this into electoral politics or to recall or whatnot, but. One of the things that I am looking at and sort of trying to determine in terms of what is different between the 30s and now is that there does not seem to be even the latent, or maybe it's just super, super latent, awareness, like class awareness, worker solidarity that may have existed in the 30s in part because of how severe the immiseration was, and maybe in part too because a lot of these people were like only a generation or two removed from or if at all from much broader sort of like movements like this, whether it was from the old country or not.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting as you're speaking, you're actually feeding me well here. Okay, we shouldn't project mid-1930s onto early 1930s. When Roosevelt came into power, the labor movement itself might well have been chomping at the bit to get going, but the 1920s were devastating to the labor movement, really devastating. So when Roosevelt launches, his own, if you like, campaign of 1932 garners the attention of John L. Lewis, the head of the United Mine Workers, the most militant in many ways, and Sidney Hillman, the head of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. And what happens? So he gets the socialist Hillman and the otherwise Republican Lewis to recognize that Roosevelt can be the political vehicle. So what happens is when he's first elected, mostly because of the crisis of the day in the Depression, it's also the case he could have just gone ahead with welfare as we know it. He could have literally initiated a whole series of relief programs. But no, right away, he recognized the imperative of enabling workers to organize. And similarly today, I support Bernie. I'm going to make it very clear. And it's the case that I think we're at one of those moments because you think about 2015, going into that campaign, you had the Fight for 14, you had Black Lives Matter, yep. You had the Moral Monday movement down in North Carolina. I mean, I could go on and on. The movements were there. They didn't coalesce, however. And I believe that if Bernie had been the candidate, and I remember, Wisconsin went Republican.
Yes.
And it didn't go Republican because people adored Trump, though more people adored him than I would have cared to have known. But it was the case that people were pissed. They wanted a punch in the nose, the establishment. And there was a poll done in 2015 of Republicans and Democrats. What kind of change do you want in America? And the majority of Americans, this was a major poll, I refer to it in the book, the majority of Americans wanted radical change. So when Bernie is prevented in many ways from really running the campaign because of the Clinton establishment, basically, where do they go? They turn to the guy who will at least if he's not going to bring the kind of change they might really want, I can assure you that they were ready to punch in the nose of the Democratic establishment. So what I'm getting at is, don't underestimate the percolation that exists in America today. I mean, we saw it, admittedly, at the very outset in the Women's March. I mean, that was huge, right? We've seen it in continuing campaigns. We saw it, you know, it's not on the scale of a million people, but we saw it at Queensbridge Park the other day.
Right.
There is an enthusiasm. And I had plenty of students who were really ready to go to work for Bernie, okay? More importantly, I had students who said to me, I would have liked to have voted for Bernie. My parents wanted to vote for Bernie. But they just couldn't vote for Clinton. They remembered in their own way the 1990s.
Right. So the argument is that a President Sanders would take office and push legislation that, I mean, because this is a pretty perennial argument that we have about Democrats, is that unlike the Republicans, when the Democrats get in office, they go immediately towards, to the extent that they attempt anything ambitious, towards legislation that is that may or may not bring material benefit to people, but is not a function of maintaining power and building power. And so in this instance, what you're saying is, like, you know, Sanders gets in fairly, you know, not terribly radical moves to enhance the ability of labor to organize could increase the power. And so you're harnessing all the things we're seeing with the teachers across the states, or you're seeing with GM workers,
right,
or you're seeing with whatnot. Given statutory a little bit of like some juice on a statutory level, you're saying will propel,
yes,
these movements.
You came to Wisconsin in 2011. Where was Barack Obama, who said when he campaigned he'd put his marching shoes on if workers were out on strike? Now, did we really expect
him? He couldn't find them. The shoes were lost.
Did we really expect him to come and occupy the state capitol?
Bob Iger's house.
Well, you know, there was people. I mean, by 2011, it was quite clear that he was not going to. But people felt like he was going to do this. And to a certain extent, look, we were also told in 2008 that we were going to get EFCA.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Right.
That went away immediately.
Right.
And to the detriment of the power of Democrats. I mean, This is one of the things that they do not do almost religiously. And, you know, just this is on a day where Kristen Sinema, you know, said, like, we're going to reinstitute the filibuster if we take power.
Yeah. Do you think that speaks, though, because I'm always reminded of George McGovern, who a lot of people, you know, is a hero in many ways. But he recorded a video against EFCA. I remember this.
Well, he was against
unions. And he had his own. Right. Because he had his own. Yeah. But I'm saying, but the broader structural argument besides George McGovern's own personal bad feelings and the unions being dirty with him or whatever is I guess Stoller talks about this too. How do you reconcile the split between the kind of professionalization of the Democratic Party with retrieving the labor aspect?
Yeah. Lots of thoughts came to mind. Let me just quickly. So for example, Republicans had a president named Ronald Reagan, who when he campaigned, he quoted Thomas Paine, Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt. Now, it was a complete perversion of the past and a brilliant hijacking of history. But he let people know, he used Paine's most radical words. We have it in our power to begin the world over again. Now, my friend Michael knows that I was actually upset with Bernie in 2016. Even if he wasn't going to be able to win, I wanted him to really, after he gave the speech at Georgetown University in November of 2015, I wanted him to stay on track. I wanted him to cultivate in all of these young people a sense of, in Langston Hughes, you know, let's make America America again, the America that has never been. And he didn't stick to it. He went back to the Scandinavian story over and over again, which she used against him, Hillary, in the debates. This isn't Denmark or something to that effect. This time, however, and I can't tell you he read my book, but he surely read my mind in his own way, he not only goes back to Roosevelt, he actually then makes, just yesterday, I believe, he tweeted again to his millions of followers, an economic bill of rights. We're going to create an economic bill of rights. And it is FDR's bill of rights with an additional thing, the Green New Deal, that we should have an environment that we will feel safe to live in and to leave to our children. I think there's an energy this time, and it would be tragic, absolutely tragic, if the Democrats really did do everything in their power to prevent the will of the people. That's
but
I
mean,
say.
Is that? I mean, is that? Is do you feel like in this instance? I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on this aspect, yeah. but do you feel like that's happening? I mean, I look at the you know at the polls, and I think it's quite possible. We won't really. Well, I happen to think that we won't really have a sense of what's going on until Iowa, until we actually see the vote tallies in Iowa. Because if Bernie's theory of the case is that we are helping with organizing around the country, which they are, that they're building a almost like a you know everybody talks about a ground game, but they're talking about a really a different type of ground game.
Yeah.
That we, you know, which involves people who've been sitting on the sidelines who would not be asked or considered in the likely voter models. But putting that aside for a moment, like when you look at the rate, like why are we not seeing more support for Bernie in this sense? And because from when I look at the polling, even with Elizabeth Warren, a lot of the people's second choice is not Bernie. It's Harris or Buttigieg or whatever.
Well, it is interesting that when they ran the poll as to who beats Trump, and I think this was in Iowa, MSNBC somehow left the Bernie result.
Yes,
I mean, I know these are not trivial things.
No, I know.
These are not. And there is a significant effort, basically. I mean,
well, of course.
On. You even have the likes of Mimi Rocha on MSNBC saying that Bernie creeps her out.
Of course.
That should be on Fox, not on MSNBC.
Of course.
So all I'm getting at is this. What I'm saying is that Bernie is appealing to young people and working people. And Elizabeth Warren is especially appealing, I believe, this is my sense of things, to white professional classes.
Yeah.
And I also get the feeling that if you look closely and you imagine the possibility that these two things can be brought together in a single campaign, there's no question that we're going to have some kind of progressive candidate in the Democratic Party. And people think, well, Trump is going to break up the Republican Party. Look, if the Democrats don't go with a progressive candidate, Bernie I prefer or Warren, you'll see the Democratic Party break up.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I mean, when we say if the Democrats don't do this, we're talking about just people who are voting. I mean, I don't get the sense that I definitely think the Mimi Rocas of the world and MSNBC. I mean, there's a preference, of course. I mean, I would be shocked, frankly, if a company that is, you know, half owned by Comcast and half owned by GE was
right.
like,
sure,
yeah, we're just going to play this one straight down the middle. And, you know, if
right.
we're going to.
Well, then we're going to have to find out how good the ground game is in Iowa, aren't we?
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, I think that's the idea. I mean, I guess. I hope, you know, knock on wood. But all right, let's talk a little bit about Thomas Paine, because you also
sure.
Say that he was, throughout the different essays and the speeches yeah. that you've given over the course of those 10 years, you circle back to Thomas Paine quite a bit. Why Thomas Paine?
Well, for a start, as I'm here in Brooklyn right now, my family's a Brooklyn family. I actually, in quotes, met Thomas Paine for the first time over on Eastern Parkway across from the Brooklyn Museum. Have we ever talked about that?
No. Well, I sort of know the story because you talk about it in the book.
I do. Right. And it is the case that my grandfather, a trial lawyer here in New York City, kept his law books in the office and he kept his private books at home. And when I was 10 years old, I just immersed myself in this stuff. I didn't understand very much. But one of the things that really fascinated me is he had a book that argued that it was Thomas Paine who wrote the Declaration and not Thomas Jefferson, which, of course, was not true. But for a 10-year-old, it's to license my ability to make some kind of argument that my teachers were wrong, okay? But I think—
You lost those arguments, is my understanding.
I never got 100% on the test. Never. But
I didn't understand. When I read that in the book, like, I didn't fully understand it. Was it like saying, like, the spirit of Thomas Paine?
No,
this
was a fellow named Joseph Reed or a name like that.
Specifically saying, like, they tell you it's Jefferson.
He wrote a whole book making the claim. And by the way, to this day, there are foolish enough people to make that kind of claim. They were so obsessed with Thomas Paine that they just make that argument. Now, why do I know it's not true? Not just because I didn't get 100% on the test. Because if Thomas Paine had written the Declaration, it would have been even more revolutionary than what Thomas Jefferson and his buddies put together in Philadelphia. That's why, okay? Because you could imagine at the end of the Declaration, reading that Declaration, it was still conceivable that you would have had some kind of monarch, maybe an elected monarch. And which is why so many of the founders beyond Jefferson himself feared Paine's pen. John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, Gouverneur Morris, they feared his pen. I mean, he had a confidence in the American people. And by the way, during the Revolution, the Declaration was not considered the important document. All the way through the Revolution, it's common sense that people first toast. It's only later, years later, that people start laying hold of the Declaration with, you know, equality, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But Paine imbues American life, I believe, with a radical imperative, a radical impulse. Don't forget, in this original document, he's the guy who's able to bring together a coalition that enables the revolution to become the rebellion to become a revolution.
Well, I mean, give us some specifics.
Well, the one that most people ignore about it, and I'll go right to the heart of the matter, is that he called for the separation of church and state in common sense. He said government should have no place in religion other than to make sure that everyone gets to practice it as they please. And there were Baptists and Methodists and Presbyterians down in Virginia who had no intention of fighting on behalf of the Virginia planters like Washington and Jefferson until they saw that and they realized they weren't all going to have to be Anglicans in a new republic. That's one example, okay? I mean, that's the one I would go to, you might say. But he also lays out a constitutional a model of a constitution. He called it a charter. And it's a highly democratic charter. Even has the idea of a rotating president. In fact, he opens common sense by talking about our, if you like, instinctive sociability and our instinctive democratic impulses. He doesn't even talk about independence or anything like it until well into the 50-page pamphlet. So people responded to this. I mean, Washington himself never – he was already in battle, Washington, but he had never come out in favor of independence. And then he sees that his own men are reading this, and he actually writes to I think it's – a friend of his down in Philadelphia, back in the so-called capital, and he says, this pamphlet, Common Sense, is working a wondrous change in the minds of the men, and that's the moment that he comes out and actually says independence. But the founders knew all about this happening. The Continental Congress would never have ever declared independence if it wasn't the fact that 100,000 people had bought and innumerable people had read Common Sense or heard it read, and town meetings, north and south, were sending notes to Philadelphia. We want independence. And it was pretty clear that when they had in mind independence, they wanted a small r, democratic republic. This is this first truly revolutionary moment, not just in America. This is the first truly revolutionary moment in modern history. And it was Americans. And that's why what Paine said to them is, you think you're fighting for British rights, but think about what you're doing. You've already thrown the British out, basically. You're governing yourselves, like anarchists would have said. So now the thing is, we fight for not even American rights. We fight for human rights. I get really excited because I...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's fascinating.
And that's why I'm excited. We're in that kind of moment now. I'm not telling you we're going to have this revolution with a capital R, but I think we're at a moment not unlike the 1930s where with the right kind of outcome in the elections. If Americans get it in themselves to think about who they are, because I'm asking for Democratic leaders, I'm asking for people like you and me and Michael and Matt and Jamie, we got to start reminding Americans who they are. Criticism is not going to sell political change in this country. It's going to be when Americans hear we're on their side.
I don't want to be awkward here, but just in the spirit of honesty, Sam has called Thomas Paine, quote, overrated. So
he obviously didn't live on Eastern Parkway.
Close to Eastern Parkway. What do you think about? I mean, as you know, as I was reading your book, and I guess you know, like I say, I just had Stoller on with a similar mission, maybe a slightly different perspective, maybe I don't know, but a similar mission insofar as like reminding people as to what the history has been of these things as a way of making a future less more tangible, I guess, less ethereal and ephemeral and more tangible.
Right.
I mean, To what extent, too, like, you know, were there actually like material conditions that, I mean, because for, you know, fortunately, since Bernie's election, I think, or I should say candidacy in 2016, I haven't had to do this as much, but all through the aughts and into 2015, I would carry around in my wallet a laminated version of the top marginal tax rates during the 1950s. Just
yeah, I know,
because I would go into, you know, because I would have arguments with people in the bar, and you know, before there was smartphones.
I used to have to carry around because I couldn't believe it.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. So people wouldn't believe you, and and I would do it, and just
you would actually whip that out of the bar. Of course you absolutely course. Would. Absolutely.
It's embarrassing, but it's even, also no, it's right on the money.
Actually. It's great.
But
literally on the money.
But there, it seems to me that there's also like a whole host of, you know, just the idea of free college.
Yeah.
Like this is not such a fantastical notion. We are 30, 40 years removed from it in you know,
the University of California.
I mean,
what can I just say? When I came to Wisconsin 42 years ago, I'm originally from New York, as I've said, well, New Jersey, New York. And I arrived in Wisconsin, and I used to say to the students, you have essentially free tuition here. I mean, it's really remarkable how little you're having to pay. But that's 42 years ago.
Right.
And during these many decades, whether they were Republicans or Democrats, the fact is that what they're paying as a share of their education must be at least 40% now in Wisconsin, which was the greatest state system in the country, and now is in serious trouble.
Right.
Okay. So, I mean, this question, and students wouldn't borrow when I got there. And now I've got students graduating from a state university such as Wisconsin, $50,000 in debt.
Right. I'm convinced that the increase in tuition at schools like University of Wisconsin have basically created an upward pressure on tuition across the board. And so, and because you could talk about what happened in Wisconsin and you multiply that times, like, you know, 25, 30 times where there were great state school systems that used to, if you were in state, the tuition would be, you know, it wouldn't be 100% free, but it was like, it was just a reasonable cost that you could address in a myriad of different ways. I wonder to like, you know, across the board, what other examples are there like that of things that we perceive today as being sort of far-fetched? Or like, we can't afford that. Or
how about a meaningful job?
Right.
How about a meaningful job? You go to college, even if you're paying your way through or you're whatever it is, and you know when you come out, there's a meaningful job. I mean, I think back to when I was coming out of college in 71, and I was going on to grad school. But there were plenty of opportunities that I could have gone into, whether they were political or museums, or who knows how many possibilities. Today, we've completely, because of four decades of this classwork from above, we've forgotten the very idea. When's the last time you ever heard of someone speak of the public good?
Right.
Okay. And by the way, here in New York, you do more in many ways for all of the devastation we've witnessed over these many years than what's been happening, say, in states like Wisconsin and Michigan and so on. I mean, you know, I mean, people are, look, here's what I'm saying. I believe that Americans actually yearn. I think Americans still feel the impulse that I'm talking about. I don't think we have to plant the impulse. I think it's a matter of whether or not we'll speak to the impulse. And that's exactly what Paine did. That's frankly what Lincoln came to do. It's what FDR did. And I think the task right now is for all of us, and perhaps with the right guy or woman in the presidential nomination seat, that we have to speak to Americans, not tell them what they don't know, but literally engage their fundamental American imagination, which I know younger people have sometimes think it's kind of Pollyannish for me to say, but I can see it in my own students. In 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president, remember? Yes, we can.
Right.
I was amazed at how many of my students were ready to go do it. Mm. And he took office, and he dropped it.
Totally.
Dropped it. And I was even surprised that there would even be a generation that would respond to, say, the likes of Bernie Sanders. Wasn't it remarkable? Believing, yes, we can.
I think, you know, the interesting thing is, and I had conversations with some people actually now are working for Bernie and had worked a little bit for Obama in that. And about the idea of how disillusioned, like I was genuinely concerned after 2008 that the issue would be, you have people who were were promised something, not nothing specific, but more of an idea of what it was possible. And I was genuinely concerned that there would be like a lost generation of people who are just like, politics has disappointed me so much, I'm going to walk away. And I think really almost the opposite happened. It was like, we can't rely on him, and we have to do something more dramatic. I mean, I think that's where Occupy came from and the whole impetus behind that. And it's stunning how far we've come since Occupy. Nobody talked about wealth inequality. Well, I mean, Bernie was, but I mean, no, it was not. It was just not mentioned in polite circles or even impolite circles.
Just left academics just nobody for gave 40 it. Years. Right. We were going on about it. Right. But, you know, yeah, you're absolutely right.
And I guess the question is, you know, this time, will that energy be harnessed or at the very least enhanced or in any way fed as opposed to just sort of left on the vine to wither and die?
Yeah, well, I'd like to think I was a prophet, but I'm not. But I actually do believe, I'll be very clear about it, I think the one candidate who can harness it, engage it is the way I'd like to think of it, is Bernie Sanders. I like Elizabeth Warren. I like her agenda, okay? But honestly, I don't think she can win in Wisconsin. I don't think she can engage young people and working people in the way that I know Bernie can.
Is that a charisma issue for you, or is it like a personal magnetism?
Well, do you think Bernie
magnetism?
Has charisma? It is a curious thing, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm asking, is there something specific about his program or his approach, or is it just something as a personality?
Can I go with my most outlandish theory? I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I just wonder to what extent, you know, they see him as like, the grandfather or great-grandfather. And they know America in the past was better than what they're about to inherit. And to them, is this their link? And, you know, they may not do the numbers, but is this their link to that moment of the generation, the greatest generation, and what they accomplished in the 30s and 40s? Is it possibly that? That's my outlandish theory, okay? Otherwise, I think it's because...
Joe Biden feels older. He's not, but he does feel older.
And he looks older, too. Right. Has no and so on.
Yeah, but he doesn't carry any... I mean, there is something... I always joke, like, Corbyn and Sanders are like these Obi-Wan Kenobi guys who, like, held a certain tradition.
Well, so from your perspective, to the extent that he can do that in Wisconsin and someone like Warren can't, that's a function just of his...
Sam, it came to me as a surprise. I'm Jewish. I'm from the New York area. I'm in the Midwest. Could I have imagined an even older Jewish guy could possibly have come out to the Midwest and literally become a celebrity, a hero, that my students would be talking to me about a guy into his 70s like that? So there's something about it that it's we could come up with a million theories, but it happened.
All right, but I'm asking. Yeah. I mean, I'm just asking what your theories are in terms of like why in a place like Wisconsin, it has to do with him as an individual, as opposed to.
Well, maybe who knows? Maybe it's because it comes out of Vermont,
right?
Even though he brings the Brooklyn with him, right? Maybe it's because people discovered him, he spoke to them. I'll give you the best example that I remember from 2016. Hillary Clinton went to Four Freedoms Park here in New York City to launch her campaign. And she never actually even mentioned what the Four Freedoms were, by the way, but she did it from there. But more importantly, the slogan was, I want to fight for you. I want to be your champion. And I knew it was all over, ultimately. And why? Because we don't want someone to fight for us. We want someone to encourage the fight in us. And that's where Bernie goes. When he was asked in the debates on television by Anderson Cooper or somebody, what are you going to do if the Republicans won't give way or if the Democrats won't even give way in your policy? He said, that's when Americans have to step forward. They have to be outside the window. They have to let these folks know what it is that they elected me for and what it is they want. It's little expression, but I think it's very indicative. Not me, us. And I have more confidence that Bernie won't turn on Americans abandon Americans as young Americans as Obama did, because Bernie's been doing this his whole life.
Right.
He doesn't come out of a Republican background. He comes out of a democratic socialist background. Sorry, I mean, I can't even believe I'm this enthusiastic about Bernie when I think back to how he didn't do in 2000, because I wanted him to cultivate the American imagination more than he did in 15 and 16. But this time, he just seems to have it.
Well, here he is actually with Hardwood. Is that his name? Hardwood?
No, Harwood.
Harwood.
Wait, what did you say?
From CNBC. And he answers that question that you just said. Like, you know, what if you don't get Joe Manchin? What if you know, Joe Manchin or, you know, Chris Coons, I guess, or Kristen Sinema or...
Or even Sherrod Brown.
Or Sherrod Brown, although he's going to be the least of the problems. But
absolutely. I like Sherrod Brown.
Right.
But he made some remarks recently that really unsettled me.
Well, we can talk about that in a moment. But here's what Bernie says he would do, which is... Specifically, what Barack Obama would not do, even in the ACA fight, when Joe Lieberman was basically holding up the potential to buy into or to drop Medicare to 55, I think it was. Here is John Hardwood asking him that same question.
Even if you have a successful election, you get elected, even if it's successful to the point that Democrats win a small majority in the Senate, is Joe Manchin going to vote for your program?
Yeah.
Is John Tester going to vote
Damn
for
right
your program?
Damn right they will. You know why? And they're friends of mine.
Yeah.
Listen, we're going to go to West Virginia, which is maybe the poorest state, well, one of the poorest states in this country. Look, what happens right now, your average politician sits around, and he or she thinks, they say, let's see, if I do this, I'm going to have the big money interest putting 30-second ads against me. So I better not do it. But now they're going to have to think, if I don't support an agenda that works for working people, I'm going to have President Sanders coming to my state and rallying working class people. You know what? At the end of the day, the 1% is very powerful. No denying that. Mm-hmm. The 99%, when they're organized and prepared to stand up and fight, they are far more powerful.
So let me ask you this in terms of like of you obviously write quite a bit about FDR and Bernie specifically modeled this campaign in some respects after FDR by launching it in that way. How did FDR do that? What Bernie's talking about? Go into a state or go into were there examples of times where he went in and convinced reluctant?
Yes. So, for example, he actually turned on the Democrats in Wisconsin in 1936 and basically backed the La Follette progressive Republicans. Hmm. Look. The New Deal depended on a lot of senators, but there were three senators who were absolutely fundamental to making it happen. And oddly enough, two of them came out of the Republican tradition. One of them was Robert Wagner of New York, Democrat, one of the most progressive Democrats of the day. The other two were Bob La Follette Jr. of Wisconsin, not the father who was the famous capital P progressive, but very much, in fact, even more fighting in many ways than his father, especially regarding labor issues, okay? And then George Norris of Nebraska, another progressive Republican. And his thing was infrastructure. And that's why he and Roosevelt got together, because TVA is basically Norris's idea that Roosevelt was keen on because of what he did up in the St. Lawrence area here in New York State. So he knew how to engage those who were not necessarily Democrats. And by the way, sidebar to all this, in 1944, Wendell Willkie, who had been the Republican candidate in 40, and Franklin Roosevelt talked about creating, off the record, talked about creating a new party, a liberal party, a liberal labor party. And Willkie said to him, well, what are we going to do with the Southern Democrats? And he said, let them go off and do what they want. Okay.
Right.
And he figured there were Republicans who were still liberal, at least. They were going to craft this new party. Willkie died very young, and Willkie died in his 40s, Roosevelt died in his early 60s. But it is the case that Roosevelt didn't hesitate to smack down, well, to turn away from Democrats who were not prepared to do it.
And we should say, you know, this is at a time where 60 years prior, maybe less actually, 50 years, you had the Republican Party was very progressive. The public schools and all part of Reconstruction to rebuild society. A lot of the things like public schools were invested in, and
Lincoln corresponded with Marx,
but
or at least you read him in the Herald Tribune.
But the things that you've just outlined, to the extent that you did, were transactional between a senator and the president, right? Like, you like infrastructure.
Yeah.
Where was the part where he marshals?
Okay. Let me give you a beautiful example that will also fit in with the teacher strikes and those things. In 1934, the Kohler workers, you know, when you go flush your toilet and wash your hands, Kohler Company. Right?
Okay.
Okay. The Kohler workers went out on strike because the company was not going to recognize their effort to organize, which was supposedly part of the law now because of the National Industrial Relations Act. Roosevelt came to Green Bay, Wisconsin, which was a mere 60 miles north of Kohler, Wisconsin. And he gave a speech in August of that summer in which he talks about how workers, how immigrant generations and Americans had to fight for their rights as workers. And it was clearly his endorsement of the strike down there. And it was all, and it was also his way of telling Wisconsin Democrats, you better do the right thing.
Right. Because here's a shot across the bow.
Right. Okay. So that was an example of turning out. Okay. By the way, regarding polls, in 1936, one of the major polls conducted showed Roosevelt was going to lose the election. And he won by the greatest landslide up until that time, the greatest landslide Americans had ever seen in, up until that time, because they didn't realize that most people didn't have telephones, right? So they had called people who all had money. And everybody else, the working people, if they, you know, they just didn't have it. So similarly, I'll hesitate on endorsing any of these polls until we see the outcome, perhaps, of Iowa. I mean, I think that Roosevelt knew how to mobilize very effectively and how to endorse pretty clearly. Also, when he ran in 32, most historians get this all wrong. They tell you, well, he didn't really know what he was going to do when he came into office. Bullshit. Sorry, can I? Bullshit. Okay. Sorry.
he was going to do it.
Sorry. Yeah. He, on the campaign trail, if you read his speeches, I'm putting together, by the way, a volume of FDR's speeches on democracy. They'll be out this spring. It's going to be FDR and democracy. He went state to state, and he talked about the what he was going to do and about the imperative of people being organized, defending their rights. He even gave like a Sunday sermon in Detroit, okay, which clearly would have been heard by workers, because whenever he talked about what he would do, he didn't sound like the welfare president. That wasn't him. I don't even think he really cared for welfare. He wanted to create jobs, and he wanted to empower workers. Now, he hesitated on endorsing the Wagner Act at the time, not unlike Lincoln hesitated to endorse his own possibility of issuing the Emancipation Proclamation, because he needed to know that he had the people behind him.
Right.
And when he knew that in 35, when it was pretty clear, he did. So, I mean, can I say that Bernie will be another FDR? He doesn't have to be another FDR. He just has to be Bernie. Okay. But we have these precedents. And you said to what extent these things matter. I really do think, I'm going to repeat myself, I think Americans carry around that impulse planted way back, Thomas Paine and the promise in the Declaration, and the greatest of presidents have harnessed that. Read Lincoln, it's always the Declaration he goes back to. Actually, he would have liked to have done Thomas Paine more in his speeches, but Paine was a deist and Lincoln was already attacked for his irreligious beliefs. Franklin Roosevelt definitely knew of Thomas Paine. He resisted, he resisted, he resisted. Then in 1941... he goes all out in a speech on the Washington's birthday address to rally Americans to be able to pursue the war effort. And by the way, Eleanor Roosevelt, who was very close to a lot of young socialists and communists back in the late 30s, she wrote a little book called The Moral Basis of Democracy in 1939, I think it was. And in there, the most referred to figure is Thomas Paine. Mm. Because these folks, they had a sense and a sensibility of what their fellow citizens yearned for and might well respond to. And I think Bernie's finally come to understand that. I think for too long he failed to do it. We've seen him doing it now.
Do you think Sam could get into trouble if he ran against Schumer quoting Thomas Paine too much?
No, I think
questions about his religious identity?
By the way, I'll move to New York and vote for him. I'll at least come and work for him.
Wow. Major news. I can't believe you didn't give that breaking news drop.
I'm putting that in the war chest. And when I open it up in the spring of... of 2020 or 2021, I guess. I don't know when I'd have to declare. But
what does someone like Chuck Schumer harness in his fellow citizens?
He's got the Baileys in his corner.
The Baileys, right. My imaginary friends. Right. They don't care about all this Michigas.
Yeah.
More a harness on them than
in
them.
Yeah.
Harvey K., the book is Take Hold of Our History. holding it here in my hand. Make America Radical Again. We'll, of course, put a link to it at thatmajority.fm.
Thank you.
So awesome to have you in studio.
It's great. We finally got to meet you here in studio. I love it. Thank you.
Indeed. All right. Let's take a quick break. We're going to head to the fun half in a moment. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget, subscribe to the AM Quickie. 5 minutes every morning gives you the top headlines. We're getting it. Brendan, when do we post those now?
Around 8:30.
They're out by 8:30 now.
It's early.
So, it's early. And you can also get it through the app at majorityapp.com. It's all searchable. The app has been refreshed, and so check that out. And don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Michael, today is Tuesday. My understanding is that Harvey's not going to leave.
Harvey's staying right here. He's going to be grading our work throughout the day. The inimitable left is best. And Lula Livre, actually.
Lula Livre, absolutely.
Yes, Professor K. I just saw... I can't believe I'm forgetting his name, but the head of the AFL-CIO just went
Trumka.
Trumka was in Curitiba giving Lula an award. I thought of you.
Fabulous.
That was fantastic. Professor K will be in studio with us. We're going to be talking about more of this type of thing, but probably getting a little bit more deeper into Wisconsin. I really want to tease out something that Sam certainly has talked about a lot because he was there. But the more I think about things, that uprising against Scott Walker was very, very important in our modern politics. So we'll be talking about that and making America radical again. Crystal Ball's also joining us. And we're going to be talking about, I think it's one in every 17 Chileans are on the street. This is maybe the most important thing happening on the planet right now.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about that and why it gets really so little press attention, especially when you can find a pattern that connects to Lebanon, to Iraq, to Haiti, to Ecuador. This was jam-packed. We're a bit off schedule. We also have an interview with Shama Sawant because November 5th, and people are already voting in Seattle, she needs to hold her seat on the Seattle City Council. I would actually suggest that her getting elected from Socialist Alternative in 2013 was another one of these little drops in the puddle of people coming back. Amazon's alone has put $1 million into defeating her. So it was a great conversation with her, but I also just would encourage all of us to do what we can do to help support her because they're really trying to knock her out, as well as some actual progressive Democrats. So streaming starts at 6 o'clock tonight, 7 the main show, pre-stream at 6, patreon.com/TMBS, illicit history of Pepe Escobar this weekend. Thanks, everybody.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we're also having on Professor K to talk about social revolution and what his take on that is. Just kidding. Although you're welcome to, if you want to.
What time are we doing that?
We usually record on Sundays, actually.
Well, I'll be home if you want to talk to me.
You're still going to be here.
All right.
Still going to be in the studio.
That's I wanted to ask you something about
that.
You
got
that,
a Harvey K. Sleeping bag.
I'd be happy to, Jamie, sometime if you want to Skype it or phone it, whatever.
All right, cool. This week on the actual Antifada, we have Minion's Death Cult, or Minion Death Cult, a very funny podcast that kind of combs the best of the cursed boomer comments from the internet. And we go over some of those. We tell some spooky stories because it's Halloween. And that is coming out tomorrow. Also, last week's episode is still up, wherein we talk about music and the new issue of Commune Mag with Sham Khanna, editor of Commune, and Josh Strawn from the band Azure Swan. Also, History is a Weapon just came out on Friday, which is our special premium offering where Sean KB and Matt Chrisman from Chapo Trap House really nerd out about history. This is a two-parter. In part one, they talk about the rise of suburbia and the invention of the American middle class as a way to kind of reduce the class conflict that is always there underneath the surface. So check it out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
I did my Salem Witch Trials episode of Literary Hangover. Among other things, we talked about, I'm a free speech warrior, as you guys like to know. So we talked about attack on free speech that followed the witch trials by Governor Phipps on behalf, basically... Massachusetts had just got its charter reinstated by England, and they needed to be on their best behavior, but it turned out that they, as that was happening, were killing a whole bunch of innocent people as witches. And so Governor Phipps commissioned Cotton Mather to write basically a cover-up official version of events, and then outlawed anybody talking about it for a few years. And so we talk about how that eventually crumbled and discredited the theocracy. So check that out, folks.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.